So we had a couple of last-minute faculty changes, including for this program. Dr. Srinivas is unable to get here, but she's going to join us virtually. Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Good morning.
Good morning. We're going to talk about prostate cancer today, and Matt, who's from the Mass General in Boston, and Sandy, who's coming in today from Stanford. Oh, yeah, I just want to remind you about your Pelican. This is from the, we're going to talk later about the Embark study. We showed, this is a slide Matt showed, I think it was last year here, actually. This is what we call the Pelican graph. This is what we want to see in oncology. The Pelican opened their mouth wide because it's such an impressive, we've shown this to a bunch of other solid tumors. So you need to be able to do this as well. So Matt, you're going to talk about hormonal therapy of prostate cancer. And before we get started, I just, you know, one of the things you're going to talk about is the EMBARK study, which to me is one of the most fascinating trials that's come out in oncology, period, in the last couple of years. And of course, the main finding, this is an M0 disease, which, you know, when you think, hey, Sandy, how's it going?
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for joining us. I know you're not able to get here, but hopefully everything will work well technically, and it'll be just like you're sitting over here right next to Matt. So we were just talking a little bit about how fast things are moving in oncology in general, but also particularly in prostate cancer. Matt, I can remember with M0 disease for a long time, we were looking at the Johns Hopkins retrospective database. People said, you know, we're never going to be able to do controlled trials in these kind of situations. And all of a sudden, we just saw a flood of phase 3 trials coming into prostate cancer, so much in development. Any thoughts about this, you know, how things are now compared to the way maybe even 10 years ago, how sort of dry things were?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of historical misunderstandings about prostate cancer. They're manyfold. And I think the, you know, really extraordinary body of work has helped debunk a lot of those myths. And there's a lot of hope now. We've really made substantial progress in the field, particularly with the AR pathway inhibitors.
So, Sandy, we were talking about the EMBARK study, which, of course, you know, we're seeing more and more intensification of hormonal therapy in prostate cancer demonstrating benefit. It seems to go as far down, almost like, you know, breast cancer. The lower the stage, you still see benefit when you add to LHRH agonists alone. Any situations right now, Sandy, where you're using LHRH agonists without adding anything to it?
I mean, very rare, right? I mean, we now have more than 10,000 patients demonstrating that intensification helps. But having said that, I would say there's a rare patient. You know, we now, people are living longer. We have octogenarians and people in their 90s. So frailty is an important one. People want to live independently. There is some toxicity that these drugs come with, you know, either financial toxicity or risk of fractures, frailty. So that definitely comes into consideration. But I would say the numbers are few.
So Matt, and again, you'll get into the data, but before we get, you know, start looking at data, I just kind of want to get a little bit of feel for some of these issues. And again, we talked about the fact that intensification seems to always improve outcomes. So we saw that in the EMBARK study when we added enzalutamide in these high-risk M0 situations to an LHRH agonist, you saw very significant benefit. But of course, the fascinating thing that you're going to show in the data was there was also an enzalutamide monotherapy arm without LHRH agonist. I was shocked, really. I think everybody was, even to just see that. And actually, it beat out the standard of care that we've been using, LHRH agonist, had better efficacy. And of course, it raised the question, would it be an efficacy advantage? You're going to show some data comparing that. Looks like these patients has less hot flashes with enzalutamide monotherapy. It doesn't seem to be quite as much of a benefit. I'm curious, have you used enzalutamide monotherapy? And what do we know about sexual function when we don't have an LHRH agonist and we use monotherapy?
Yeah, all great questions. What I tell my patients is the side effects are different. They're not necessarily better. And it really depends on the context of the patient. The EMBARK study looked at patients who are post-primary therapy, so they've either had a prostatectomy and or prostate radiation. And most of these patients already have erectile dysfunction or sexual dysfunction on that basis. Although there are patients who would like to, who have retained sexual function and would like the opportunity to preserve it. And ENSA monotherapy may offer that benefit, but it has different side effects, more fatigue, breast symptoms that really don't occur at any substantial rate with GnRH agonist monotherapy or ADT alone. So there are different side effects, but I wouldn't say they're uniformly better.
Sandy, you know, we talk all the time, it seems like almost every program we do, about patient involvement in the decisions that are maybe hard to make. And, you know, some patients don't want to be involved, that's fine too. But for those who do you present enzalutamide monotherapy to your patients with M0 disease? And any thoughts about differential side effects? How much of an issue? We got a lot of questions about management of tolerability issues with the LHRH agonist. How much of a difference do you see in terms of hot flashes, for example?
Yeah, I think, you know, men definitely want therapy that don't lower testosterone. So it does become very relevant in this patient population. Again, these were patients who had M0 by conventional imaging. So that's also an issue that with our ultra-sensitive functional imaging that we have today, you know, what fraction are going to be M0? But irrespective of that, I think patients are coming in saying they may have had ADT during radiation, so they sense what the side effects are of having a low testosterone. So in my practice, I definitely have patients who are averse to testosterone-lowering agents. So we look to treatment with radiation, for instance, if there's oligometastatic disease. But enzalutamide has become a player and has become a discussion in this setting. And like Matthew said, I do think that the side effect profile is different. Breast tenderness, gynecomastia, nipple pain is a big discussion when we think about ENSA monotherapy. And there's a lot of strategies that we discuss with patients, including breast radiation prophylactically. Tamoxifen therapy has been used in patients to try to mitigate the side effects. But more than hot flashes, I think fatigue and breast tenderness is really a big discussion when you talk about ENSA monotherapy.
So again, yeah, the best efficacy you're going to see, and certainly patients who are focused on that, which I think is most patients you're going to see, well, with combination therapy. I was flashing back to the fact that I think the biggest trial that was ever conducted in cancer was actually done on bicalutamide adjuvant monotherapy, like about, this is when we started getting involved with prostate, I think in 2000, and they had to deal with the gynecomastia, et cetera, but they had like 9,000 patients, but they were too low risk to see any benefit, I guess.
Exactly. It was sort of looked like it might be the tamoxifen for
right.
prostate cancer. Really, I believe it would work if you selected the right patients, but with, you know, the vision of hindsight, you can say that like the patients who were enrolled in the trial were too low risk to show a benefit for that adjuvant treatment.
One more sort of general question, Matt, before you get into the data. You know, you were sitting there watching the breast module. It's really, is all of a sudden, like almost all of oncology have been so biomarker driven. And now in terms of hormonal therapy, do you see that coming to prostate cancer?
We do, and I really did enjoy watching the breast session. I think we've done a lot of work to catch up to breast, although we still have some ways to go, for sure. And as I looked at Seth Wander's slide about the complexity of management, we could really generate very similar slides for prostate cancer now for patients who present with metastatic disease. The role of, you know, the thing about androgen deprivation therapy is patients uniformly respond to ADT, and the vast majority of patients respond to initial treatment with an ARPI. So we don't really need biomarker selection there. It's really for what happens after that. And there is some emerging data, high Decipher scores probably are both prognostic and predictive of benefit, actually both chemotherapy as well as ARPIs.
Interesting. All right, so you're going to review some of the data we have on hormonal therapy. One more question before you get started on the data, just sort of an update. And one of the issues that's been out there is tolerability of the androgen receptor blockers. You know, we have three main ones. There's been this thought, and a lot of it, you know, originated with you, that darolutamide might be better tolerated. As, you know, we've kind of matured and seen more data, again, any way to sort of separate out the three agents in terms of tolerability?
So three lutamides, apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide, plus abiraterone acetate, which is not an anti-androgen, but an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor, CYP17A inhibitor. We view those drugs as interchangeable for efficacy, but they have different safety profiles. So among the three lutamides, Darolutamide, I believe, is fairly perceived as best in class for safety, has the fewest drug-drug interactions, was developed not to cross the blood-brain barrier, has less fatigue, less risk for falls and fractures. That said, all three of the lutamides are quite well tolerated, and in all of the prospective randomized control trials, there's very low rates of treatment discontinuation due to adverse events.
Sandy, anything you want to add to that? Do you have any preference in general, particularly, let's say, castrate-resistant disease?
No, I think I agree with Matthew. My recommendation would be just pick the drug that you're most comfortable with, figure out how to dose reduce, how to manage side effects. And, you know, you only get one good chance with these drugs because they are so heavily cross-resistant. So pick the best drug that you're most comfortable with. And like a lot in oncology, we just learn how to manage adverse events.
All right. Okay, Matt, let's take a look at some data.
Yeah, so if there's one key takeaway from my presentation, it's that androgen deprivation therapy is no longer the standard of care for initial management of metastatic prostate cancer. Treatment intensification has been shown to improve survival with this vast body of prospective randomized controlled trials. Here are the 10 trials to date shown here. They're grouped by intervention. The three trials on top showed that the three first trials showed that docetaxel improved overall survival when added to ADT. In subsequent meta-analyses and in subgroup analyses of the individual trials, the benefit of intensification with docetaxel appears to be limited to patients with poor prognosis, in this case defined as high-volume subgroup. Subsequent trials showed that the addition of an ARPI to ADT significantly improved progression-free and overall survival. The key distinction here is that benefit appears to be conferred across all risk groups. And then more recently, two trials showed that triplet therapy, adding an ARPI to ADT and docetaxel, improved survival compared to the doublet of ADT and docetaxel. And let's go through the data here. And really, ARPI intensification is the standard of care for the vast majority of patients. So I'm going to focus on these trials. So in 2017, Latitude reported that the addition of abiraterone acetate to androgen deprivation therapy improved progression-free and overall survival. Early and consistent separation of both the progression-free and overall survival curves. You can see the hazard ratios and p-values here. This is a group of patients with poor prognosis disease, de novo metastatic disease, with other features that characterized high risk. So this followed the earlier studies that showed that docetaxel improved survival when added to ADT. So the obvious question became, well, what should you do, abiraterone or docetaxel? While to date there's been no head-to-head trial, we have the next best thing with the STAMPEDE clinical trial experience. Here the investigators compared patients within the STAMPEDE program and compared patients who are contemporaneously randomized to either ADT docetaxel or ADT abiraterone. They were not randomized head-to-head. They were contemporaneously randomized in different arms of the study. You see there's no difference in overall survival, but in all the a number of intermediate endpoints, abiraterone wins, including failure-free survival, progression-free survival, and metastatic progression-free survival. Now, there are two possible explanations for that. It could be that abiraterone is more effective than docetaxel. Alternatively, because we treat continuously to progression with abiraterone in contrast to six cycles of docetaxel, it could just represent the fact that the continuous therapy conferred the benefit for the intermediate outcomes. Nonetheless, an ARPI like abiraterone becomes much more attractive than docetaxel if the overall survival benefits are similar, and that has largely become the preferred first-line treatment for metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. A number of subsequent studies show that other ARPIs are similarly effective. These are data from the TITAN study of apalutamide and MCSPC, again showing very comparable and marked improvements in both radiographic progression-free and overall survival. A couple of really important points here is that in the TITAN trial, the enrolled patients were much more variable in their presentation. It included both de novo and recurrent metastatic disease, high and low volume, high and low risk patients. And the benefits for treatment intensification were consistent across risk groups. So this is a big contrast to docetaxel, where the benefit appears to be limited to patients with high volume metastatic disease. The benefit is also seen in high volume metastatic disease with all of the ARPI. So it isn't that docetaxel is superior in high volume disease. It's really that that's where the benefit is restricted, or so it appears. The other important point that I'll make here is that some have said, well, why give it early? I can just save it for later. Well, this is not a formal sequencing trial. In this and all the other trials I'll describe, there was a very high rate of crossover to subsequent ARPI in the control group. And despite that high rate of crossover, we see these significant improvements in overall survival. So again, the argument that you can just save the ARPF for later has really been refuted by the evidence from this and the subsequent trials.
Any comments on tolerability of apalutamide, particularly the rash?
Yeah, so I think the rash was more of an issue early on when it was first recognized. For most patients, you can treat through the rash, either, you know, brief treatment interruption, topical steroids. There are geographic differences, and I think probably racial differences in the rates of rash. In our practice, rates of rash with apalutamide are quite low, different in other parts of the world, but really I think quite manageable. And I view the safety of apalutamide and enzalutamide as very similar, not surprising as they're structurally nearly identical. The ARCHES study reported very similar data. Again, you see this very nice improvement in RPFS and OS, and confirmed the same points that I made in describing the TITAN trial, benefit seen across really all of the risk subgroups, and the improvement in overall survival was conferred despite a very high rate of subsequent ARPI, as you would have expected, in the control group. So what next? So the question then became, what is the role of triplet therapy? This is the design of the ARASEND study. This is a global randomized double-blind placebo-controlled phase 3 trial. We designed this trial in 2015, 2016, which requires some historical explanation. So this was right after one of the STAMPEDE studies confirmed a survival benefit for docetaxel, and before the LATITUDE trial first reported that ARPI intensification improved survival. So we chose ADT docetaxel as the control group because we thought that was the right thing to do. We really felt to move the needle, you had to improve upon past results. We also felt that the only way to really move the needle was going to be to show an improvement in overall survival. And so that was the primary endpoint for this study. Study included a total of 1,300 patients randomized in equal proportions to ADT docetaxel plus placebo or ADT docetaxel plus darolutamide, primary endpoint overall survival, with a number of key secondary endpoints as shown there. The addition of darolutamide to ADT docetaxel significantly improved overall survival, hazard ratio very similar to the prior studies that showed improvement in OS to ARPI plus ADT alone. Hazard ratio 0.68, highly statistically significant. The median overall survival in the control group was 48 months, very similar to the historical experience in the other prospective studies of ADT docetaxel, and the OS in the darolutamide group was not yet reached. There was a lot of interest by the community in understanding like where the benefit was seen with triplet therapy, and here we see that there are similar relative improvements in overall survival for both high volume and low volume disease, although the absolute benefit, as you would expect, was greater in patients with poor prognosis shown on the left. Similar results shown for high risk and low risk subgroups using the LATITUDE criteria. Again, similar relative benefit between high risk and low risk with the greater absolute benefit in the poor prognosis patients.
Before you go on, I want to just go to Sandy and ask her about triple therapy, and then I'm going to come back to you because, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the historical context. I remember the beginning of the pandemic when we were trying to keep people out of clinic, and at that point, it was either docetaxel or, you know, endocrine therapy, you know, androgen receptor inhibitors, which of course had never been compared, but they were the two options. And of course, people were trying to keep people out of clinic. Then your IRSEN study came out, but maybe because of the historical evolution, it kind of wasn't exactly the randomization people wanted to see, which was LHRH plus ARI plus or minus docetaxel. It was kind of the other way. And so, Sandy, you know, to me, we're kind of left. I don't know if you call this level one evidence or not. I mean, Matt and I always argue about this. That's why I'm starting with you. How are you currently deciding right now whether to use docetaxel in the hormone-sensitive setting, Sandy?
So number one is, are they a candidate for docetaxel? So I think as oncologists, we think about, I mean, there's no set criteria. There's nothing that's written in paper, but we all have the eyeball test. So are patients frail? Are they able to tolerate docetaxel? I think that's the first one. And second, I think to date, you know, volume is what we have as a marker of poor outcome. So many of these trials have consistently shown that de novo, so you can get metastatic disease either as de novo or those who have had prior local therapy. And many of our studies have shown that the outcome is different for somebody who has low volume, who has prior local therapy. So I definitely use frailty. I use volume of disease, a high volume patient who's young, fit for chemotherapy. I think that there is data to support use of triplet. And finally, I think de novo patients we know do worse. So I think these are my three criteria that I kind of use in clinic to decide if I'm going to go with triplet.
Matt, anything you want to add to that? I mean, that's usually what investigators will say. Any thoughts?
So yeah, the way I think about it is ADT plus an ARPI is the standard of care for most patients. The secondary question is, should I also add docetaxel? We don't have level one evidence for that. If I could go back in time and read the future, I would have designed ARISENS differently. But with the, you know, that's why I took a moment to describe the historical context there, because it would have been hard to justify because we didn't yet know that ADT plus an ARPI improves survival, so you might have been assigning patients to an inferior form of therapy. So yeah, so the docetaxel question is really secondary. National guidelines, including NCCN, basically say like de novo high volume, consider triplet therapy as an alternative to doublet therapy with ADT ARPI. And that's how we approach it in clinic. There are other considerations. We typically do tumor genetic testing at the beginning, patients with adverse genetic features, including, you know, loss or mutation in tumor suppressor genes, I look at as an additional consideration to use docetaxel.
Interesting. All right, so but now we do have some, you know, of course, when the ARISENS came out, everyone wanted to know, what about darolutamide alone? And of course, now you have that.
So I guess I revert to the following, which is the prevailing view and evidence says that the ARPIs are interchangeable for efficacy. So it'd be a bit unimaginable that the benefit of darolutamide was unique in combination with ADT and docetaxel. We'd already established the efficacy of darolutamide in non-metastatic CRPC, which I'll get to in a moment. But the ARINOTE study was designed to fill in sort of this hole, which was doublet therapy with darolutamide, a smaller study, 2-to-1 randomization to improve physician and patient acceptance of the design, and a primary endpoint of RPFS, not primarily designed to look at OS. To no one's surprise, ARINOTE shows this, you know, early and consistent separation of the curves for RPFS, hazard ratio 0.54, highly statistically significant, and you can see the landmark analysis is shown there. So this sort of confirms that doublet therapy with ADT darolutamide is a good option for patients with as initial therapy for metastatic prostate cancer. So EMBARK, really interesting design with a lot of sort of contemporary caveats. So this was really, I'd say, like an innovative trial in that it was addressing a series of questions, which was this, you know, AR is the best validated target in prostate cancer. In every randomized controlled trial to date, intensification with an ARPI has shown improvement in progression-free and overall survival up to EMBARK, which was designed here. This was innovative as moving earlier. We'd previously shown that intensification in non-metastatic CRPC improved survival. This was looking at non-metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer. So these are patients with a rising PSA after prior surgery and or radiation therapy, randomized to one of three arms, the control arm of ADT alone with leuprolide acetate, ADT plus enzalutamide or enzalutamide monotherapy. Patients were treated for 37 weeks, and then if they achieved an undetectable PSA, they started a holiday and then would resume treatment at PSA progression. Here are the primary, this is the primary analysis of EMBARK, the comparison of enza combination versus ADT with leuprolide, showing this improvement in metastasis-free survival, hazard ratio 0.42, highly statistically significant, as you might expect. At this time, the overall survival data is immature, so we don't know the effect of this on overall survival. This is the secondary analysis, which is the enza monotherapy arm versus ADT with leuprolide, again showing superiority to ADT alone, although the difference is smaller, hazard ratio 0.63, absolute improvement of 9% for metastasis-free survival after 5 years. And there's other data, again, the ARPIs appear to be interchangeable. There's other data with apalutamide suggesting that intensification there is similarly effective. This is a smaller randomized controlled trial, not designed with metastasis-free survival, but in this case, PSA PFS, and you can see on the left early separation of the curves with benefit conferred to the combination arm. In the right is shown triplet therapy, in this case ADT, apalutamide, and abiraterone, and consistent with the prior ASICS trial, there doesn't appear to be much of an incremental addition to combining two ARPIs in this setting, as was true in mCRPC, again, probably because of overlapping cross-resistance between these agents.
So a quick question from the audience, Shoba, and actually you skipped over a slide here which had the tolerability issues from EMBARK,
yep,
where we saw, of course, gynecomastia, as you both mentioned, but also hot flashes significantly less. So Shoba in the audience wants to know, have you ever given fezolinetant to patients with hot flashes? Any other clinical pearls about management of that?
So is this the new agent approved for
menopause, hot flashes, right?
Yeah, hard to get. We have tried it. I mean, I have to say, hot flashes, I've caused certainly a lot of hot flashes in my 3 decades of treating patients with prostate cancer. While patients don't like their hot flashes, very few men are willing to take drugs for them, partly because the drugs don't work very well and they have their own side effects. I was hopeful that this new agent would be different. But in looking at the primary data, it's really not that impressive in my opinion. I certainly would defer to my experience of my breast cancer colleagues in terms of whether it's helpful in that setting. We have tried to get it for some patients. It's a bit challenging with insurance. It's fairly expensive supportive care medication.
Sandy, anything you want to add to that under complementary strategies? Anything you see effective?
I too have not had any experience using this new drug, but oxybutynin, interestingly, made it to a New England Journal paper, you know, with a very small number. It was a case, it was just a single patient experience. But I think oxybutynin works quite well, but most patients are happy just to use a fan. You know, these are very transient. So only the ones who have wake up at night soaking bed sheets who are wanting to go on drug therapy, but age-old Megase and oxybutynin and Effexor is what I've used in my practice.
My team tells me this is an NK3R antagonist. One other thing about EMBARK, I think you mentioned, but maybe just to elaborate on it. And actually, we have an audience question from KS Kumar, but the EMBARK study used intermittent therapy. Can you talk a little bit about exactly what was done and whether you do it exactly like that? And then Dr. Kumar has a patient who wants to ask you about it first.
So this is tricky, right? So I think the EMBARK study was innovative, there's lots of questions, right? So for example, ADT alone is not an approved therapy for PSA-only recurrence. So you might argue it has a non-standard, at least unapproved, although commonly utilized control arm. Second, It did intermittent therapy, not continuous therapy, which has also never been like established as the standard. I think it's a reasonable study, but there's lots of moving parts to EMBARK. So I think I'm really looking forward to the longer follow-up, including OS. And then I think the other point that's been alluded to is, who are these patients? You know, PSMA PET has 10 to 50-fold greater sensitivity for detection of metastatic disease. So in all cases, that is our go-to imaging. We don't get conventional imaging followed by PSMA PET. We get PSMA PET, CT. And so for many of these patients, you find detectable metastatic disease, in which case you manage them as MCSPC. And if they have no detectable metastases, I could make an argument that they may be followed with no treatment.
So I'm going to go back to Sandy for this, but maybe you can give some advice to Dr. Kumar, who's got a patient on intermittent ADT for 10 years, gets a couple of doses of ADT every 2 to 3 years. He wants to know, should he continue doing it? Should he intensify? Patient's in good health, age 70.
So maybe
right.
You want me to go for...
Okay.
Let me go. Yeah, okay, Sandy.
Go ahead, Sandy.
Any thoughts about
that? I was going to say that, you know, PSA doubling time is an important thing because we all have these men in our practice. You know, slow PSA, very low PSA just changes very little over time. I think intensification for that, that's not the EMBARK patient. So one thing that what EMBARK did were people who had definitive therapy, right? So if you have somebody with negative... just biochemical recurrence who have no evidence of disease, we don't want to lose that opportunity to give them a chance for salvage radiation. So that's the first point. Second, I do think EMBARK selected patients who were high risk. So these were patients who had a rapid PSA doubling time, which was defined as 9 months. So I think for Kumar's patient who definitely has very slow rise in PSA, a long PSA doubling time, surveillance or intermittent ADT as he's been doing sounds reasonable without the need to intensify and buy additional toxicity.
All right, well, let's move on and continue with some more data, Matt.
Sure. So I think the next thing we're going to talk about is non-metastatic CRPC, studies that preceded the EMBARK study by many years, sort of establishing this idea of intensification in patients without detectable metastases. And at that the time, these studies were designed like, you know, ADT alone would be continued. You know, we'd use ineffective older therapies or just observe the patient with the rising PSA. Going back to your earlier point, Neil, there was a lot of misunderstanding, including by the FDA, which thought that this was a problem created by clinicians and that all of these men died of old age. Both are completely incorrect. Okay, these patients die from their disease and they have a survival that's similar to patients who present with metastatic disease. So if you fail non-metastatic CRPC, particularly the high-risk group that were enrolled in these trials, have a poor outcome with a median survival of only like 4 or 5 years. So this, I think I went too far. So first, the primary endpoint for these studies, which led to the approval of APA, ENZA, and DARO in that order, showed these marked improvements in metastasis-free survival. These are the original, I'm blanking on the name of the bird, pelican plots. very regionally appropriate reference. So the pelican plots showed this huge improvement in metastasis-free survival. Two-year absolute improvements across the studies, and to really exceeded expectations, and this also translated into overall survival benefits in each of the three studies. First approvals based on MFS, and then later data with longer follow-up showed this improvement in overall survival. Same point as I made in the case of the non-metastatic CSPC patients. This is a shrinking population because PSMA PET usually identifies metastatic disease, and in sort of companion trials looking at this population, not within the trials but in other data sets, nearly all of these patients have detectable metastases by PSMA PET CT. Not at all a surprise because we always believe that we are treating microscopic distant disease. So if you like, I can just briefly summarize. Main point is that the AR pathway is the best validated target in prostate cancer. It has ARPIs have an important role across a broad range of prostate cancer disease states, including mCRPC, non-metastatic CRPC, non-metastatic CSPC, mCSPC. And I didn't talk about it today. It also has intensification has a role in selected very high risk and regional risk patients as part of initial therapy, and there's going to be a lot more data to come looking at studies, looking at the addition of an ARPI to ADT and radiation in high risk and very high risk disease.
So just a couple of follow-up questions that we're going to go into Sandy's talk. How are you currently approaching patients with locally advanced disease?
So locally advanced disease, so first, by including PSMA PET-CT?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so locally advanced, so T3, T4, N1, regional risk, very high, NCCN, very high risk or regional risk. I use the STAMPEDE data and would certainly consider intensification, so ADT radiation plus an ARPI. The data from STAMPEDE is with abiraterone and prednisone. Again, I view the ARPIs as interchangeable for efficacy, so I have no problem choosing a different ARPI if I have specific reasons to do so in that patient.
So, Sandy, anything you want to add to that? And also, we mentioned the issue of how effective PSMA scanning is in picking up mets. You see a lot of patients with oligomets, Sandy. How do you define oligomets, and how do you approach local therapy?
Yeah, I think oligometastatic disease has become a new disease state. We don't really have level one evidence about how to treat those patients. So PSMA PET has really changed that field. It's hard to see something and ignore it. So I think if PSMA PET is positive, oligometastatic disease today maybe is a definition of less than 5 sites of metastasis. So our radiation therapists are definitely willing to radiate these patients. So there is data to support treating the primary. So patients will get their prostate treated, plus maybe these additional sites of metastasis with SBRT or CyberKnife.
Anything you want to add to that, Matt? And what about after local therapy in terms of systemic treatment?
Yeah, so a lot of unknowns there with oligometastatic disease. I'd say it's been around forever, as long as I've been in practice. Just to Sandy's point, PSMA PET-CT has made it a much more common scenario. If you can see it, you want to treat it. There's challenging questions, though. Who do you include? How many mets are reasonable to radiate, for example? And how often would you re-radiate when a patient develops a new site of metastatic disease? So when do you start and when do you stop? Those are very challenging questions. I generally tell patients there's diminishing returns. If we give you one shot at potentially curative therapy by radiating a solitary met, and now 2 years later you have 3 new mets, it's very unlikely you're going to benefit from additional metastasis-directed therapies, but it is a conversation.
Great. Okay, Sandy, hopefully our slide advancer will be working from California here, and you're going to talk about other modalities, particularly radioligand therapy, where prostate cancer has taken such a leadership disease in this modality.
Will do. Thank you, Neil. So CRPC, we are going to be talking about current therapy and emerging options. So I'm going to start off with our homologous recombination pathway. So what is the burden of disease? So if you look at the prevalence of these mutations, the first message is that it increases from localized disease. 2 patients with metastatic disease have a higher prevalence. What are the mutations? So BRCA2 is the most common, represents about 44% is BRCA2. And then you have a smattering other mutations such as BRCA1, PALB2, CHEK2, etc. But overall, 1 in 4 men have these germline mutations. The first therapy that came into prostate cancer was olaparib. This was in patients with CRPC. It was the PROFOUND trial. It was a large randomized trial that took men with CRPC who harbored one of these mutations that are highlighted in red. They had 2 different cohorts. Cohort A were those patients who had BRCA1, BRCA2, and ATM, and then everybody else was lumped in cohort B. Within these cohorts, there was a 2-to-1 randomization to either olaparib or to the alternate NHT. And the primary endpoint was RPFS. Here are the results. The cohort A, there was an improvement in RPFS. I think this defines the Pelican curve. There was an improvement that was statistically significant, a good hazard ratio for RPFS. you can see that the curve below is combined, both cohort A and cohort B, somewhat less, and most of the benefit is coming from the BRCA patients. There were other meaningful endpoints such as pain progression, which also favored the PARP inhibitor. Now looking at OS, so this is somewhat busy. I'm just going to have you focus on the first column. The top curve is the overall survival for cohort A. Again, was positive. And if you look at the extreme column on the right, which is the combination of the two, cohort A and cohort B, you can see that the benefit was less. And again, the predominant benefit comes from the BRCA population. The curves below is the overall survival after crossover. So a large number, two-thirds of the patients did have crossover, and the benefit persisted despite crossover favoring olaparib. So this resulted in the FDA approval for olaparib for HRR mutations in patients who have CRPC. More than one PARP inhibitor available today. So rucaparib was the other PARP inhibitor that was tested as monotherapy in CRPC. This was the Triton 3 study that was a randomized study that took patients with either BRCA mutations or ATM and randomized them to either rucaparib or physician's choice, which could include the alternate NHT or docetaxel. And RPFS was the primary endpoint. And here are the results. The top one is for docetaxel. So irrespective of whether the comparator was docetaxel or alternate NHT, rucaparib outperformed the comparator. But you can see, interestingly, to the right is ATM, where there was no benefit for patients who harbored ATM. So rucaparib also is FDA approved for patients with CRPC. And then there became a whole interest in trying to co-target the HRR pathway along with AR. And this led to three large studies in metastatic CRPC. I've just combined the three trials for you up here. The first one is PROPEL, which looked at olaparib plus abiraterone. The second one is MAGNITUDE, looking at niraparib plus abiraterone. And the third trial is looking at talazoparib with enzalutamide. So slightly different PARPs, and they had different mutations, and there were different designs. So PROPEL took all comers. In fact, only 20% of patients in PROPEL had an HRR mutation. MAGNITUDE, on the other hand, upfront had two different cohorts. They had a biomarker positive cohort and a biomarker negative. The biomarker negative closed for futility. And then TALAPRO 2 sort of combines these two together. They have all comers and they also have an HRR group. I'm just going to summarize this for you. So overall, this is my take. So in yellow, it's clear that the patients who harbor BRCA have the highest magnitude of benefit. You can see that the hazard ratio is 0.2 for some of the more potent PARPs, such as PROPEL and TALAPRO 2. The second group who benefits the most is marked in red. These are the HRR positive patients, and the ones with the least benefit are the non-HRR. Also want to point out that this is first-line CRPC. So the patients who came into these trials, very few exposure to a prior NHT. You can see in PROPEL, it was less than 1% and smaller numbers in the other two studies. About 1 in 5 had prior docetaxel, and I've highlighted what the FDA approval is. So PROPEL is just for BRCA. MAGNITUDE is just for BRCA. TALAPRO 2 had a broader approval. So now let's go on to a press release. None of these have had overall survival. So just on October 10th, there was a press release that TALAPRO 2 had overall survival benefits. So really excited to looking at the results in an upcoming meeting. I want to say that the PARPs are all not created equally. There is differential between these different PARPs. If you look at different things, whether it's PSA 50, objective response rate, BRCA and PALB2 has a much higher benefit compared to, let's say, something like CHEK2. So certainly, as we think about HRR, you want to look at the specific PARPs. I want to highlight this trial about this concept of combining this, right? There's always been a question whether it's real or not. So I want to highlight this very small study called the Brockaway trial that looked at either Abi monotherapy, Olaparib monotherapy, and then the combination. This was specifically for patients with BRCA mutation. And at progression, there was crossover for the other agent. Want to highlight the results. If you just look at the top column up here, the table, for monotherapy, Abi or Olaparib was around 14 months compared to the combination, which was doubled at 31 months. So there is something real when you do the combination, especially for the patients with BRCA mutations. I do want to highlight again, you know, this cross resistance. So today in our practice, as Matthew pointed, most of our patients are getting these NHT, whether it's in localized disease or whether it's in the metastatic hormone sensitive space. So when they come to CRPC, do we have patients in our practice who have not had exposure to NHT? And we know from prior trials that there's significant cross resistance. So what do the guidelines tell us? So NCCN has these four buckets based on prior therapy, and monotherapy PARP, both Olaparib and Rucaparib, have a space in their approved indication. For the combinations, all three have level one, category one, in patients who have not had prior NHT exposure. And in other disease states, they have with a lesser level of evidence. These are ongoing trials in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, trying to move PARPs to earlier line. We have the Amplitude as well as Talipro-3 looking at these drugs in MSHSPC. Now, I want to shift gears and talk about RLT, which is radioligand theranostics. And the first approved drug was PSMA-617, lutetium-177, based on this VISION study. So this was a large trial. Patients who had PSMA-positive disease were then randomized to either PSMA-617, lutetium-177 with best supportive care versus best supportive care. I want to remind you that this trial, patients had prior NHT, they had prior taxanes, so they had all the FDA-approved drugs that we had at that time. The primary endpoint was looking at both PFS and OS. And here are the endpoints. The trial did meet its endpoint of improving overall survival with a hazard ratio that was in the 0.6 as well as RPFS. And this quickly got adopted into our clinical practice where patients were getting RLT. Now, here are the other secondary endpoints. This is looking at RECIST-based criteria where there was response in lymph nodes, in visceral disease, and a pretty impressive drop in PSA 50 that happened in more than half of the patients. So like everything else, there is interest in moving this therapy to earlier lines. So PSMA 4 was a large randomized trial, now looking at this exact same compound in patients with pre-taxanes. So this was a randomization to either PSMA-617 or the alternate ARPI. Important to note that crossover was allowed in this study. So patients who progressed ARPI were allowed to have the study drug. No surprise, the trial did have an improvement in RPFS, which was pretty significant and meaningful. But the and we saw other secondary endpoints very similar to the VISION study. We still await the overall survival. These are the side effects that you think about with this treatment. It's been mostly dry mouth because there is some salivary gland uptake and some fatigue is what we tell our patients while they go through this. So similar to PSMA-4, there is another compound called INT. So this trial is called SPLASH. It had an identical design to PSMA-4. Slight differences, the dose of radiation is somewhat lower in the SPLASH study. And rather than every 6 weeks, patients were treated every 8 weeks. And you can see the results below that there was an improvement in RPFS. Both trials don't have an improvement in OS because of significant crossover. More than 80% of eligible patients had a crossover, which confounds the overall survival. I want to highlight on two other studies. One is PEACE-3. This was a investigator-initiated study looking at radium, which is approved in CRPC as monotherapy, but has had very little uptake. So this was a trial combining radium plus enzalutamide versus enza alone in metastatic CRPC. So first line, no prior exposure to an NHT. And really interesting that there was an improvement not just in RPFS, but in OS as well. This was just presented at ESMO, and we await the publication. But there are other pathways, just like we heard in the prior breast session. There's a lot of interest in looking at P10 loss in patients with prostate cancer. There was a prior trial called the IPATential 150, which looked at ipatasertib plus ABI versus ABI in metastatic CRPC. The trial was negative in the intent to treat population, but there was definitely a signal in patients who had P10 loss. So this led to the Capitello study looking at capivertosib plus ABI versus ABI in patients who have P10 loss, and we await the results of this study. So lots of exciting new targets, new agents, which I think will certainly make our treatment of CRPC challenging, just like patients with breast cancer, where we start thinking about what's the best sequence, what's the best drug.
So, Matt, can you talk a little bit? You know, we see a lot of patient-reported outcomes in clinical trials now, which I think is great, but that's also a challenge. What's your experience with lutetium in terms of the experience that the patient has? Sandy mentioned dry mouth. What kinds of issues come out? And also, what is life like on lutetium in terms of inconvenience, what the patient has to go through?
Yep, so happy to have this as a therapeutic option. Patient experience, my personal experience treating lots of patients with PSMA lutetium is similar to the published results. Most patients complete their planned cycle of therapy. The most common reason for treatment discontinuation is disease progression. And the common side effects include cytopenias, dry mouth, and dry eyes. And if you haven't done so, look at your next PSMA PET CT scan and you'll understand why, because everyone looks like a chipmunk. Their salivary glands light up very intensely. And that's an expected side effect of this class of medication.
Anything you can do to be helpful, Sandy mentioned?
Yeah, there are some things you can do, lozenges, oral hydration. It appears to be largely reversible, but it can be problematic in some patients. But it's certainly worth noting and warning patients about that risk.
Do you ever have to hold therapy because of cytopenias?
We do. I think that's maybe become less, as is classic. You know, when we have a new therapy, the first patients who get treated tend to be those who have no other options. As you gain experience with it and have access to the drug, you tend to move it up a little bit earlier in patients with better performance status. But certainly, yeah, it can be a reason to either interrupt or discontinue therapy, but typically in patients who have no other options for therapy.
Sandy, well, you mentioned the PSMA-4 study was so interesting, and as you say, maybe not so unexpected to see the benefit there. How are you approaching sequencing and where you put lutetium in? And what about in the symptomatic patient? Do you see a more rapid response with chemotherapy than lutetium, for example?
I think we are still learning about who derives the most benefit from lutetium. You can see in PSMA, the VISION study, as well as in PSMA-4, the PSA-50 is around 50%. So I think selection is really important, and we are learning who derives the most benefit. I have patients who have received 6 doses, and their PSA remains undetectable for more than a year, year and a half. But that's very few patients. I think that's who derives the most benefit, and we are learning who those are. I think, you know, it's definitely more attractive compared to chemotherapy. Patients who are frail, who are not chemotherapy candidates, this is a very attractive option. So really hoping and looking forward to the approval for patients pre-docetaxel. But it's nice to have all these other options. So you look at chemotherapy, you look at alternate NHT, you look for genomic testing to see if your patients have one of these HRR pathway. And I think there are other classes of drugs such as AR degraders. We are looking forward to immunotherapy with other targets such as PSMA BiTEs. So hopefully we'll have more drugs than just chemo, AR, NHTs, and RLTs.
PSMA BiTEs, I like that. Everybody's got them. Even lung cancer, we're going to talk about that next. So final question, Matt. I always liked radium. I always thought it was a cool drug, and it kind of never, caught on. What do you think about this new study with enzalutamide, and can you see yourself using that strategy?
Yeah, it comes as quite a surprise, particularly a prior study with abiraterone in combination showed no benefit and net harm by these fractures, which, you know, has been the PEACE study eliminated by use of bone targeted therapy, they eliminated the fractures, but they also show benefits. So it really comes kind of out of left field, an unexpected result. And I'm struggling with how I'm going to incorporate that into my practice, because there really should be few patients with ARPI naive MCRPC, period, hard stop, because they all should have got it as CSPC. So and then you have this combination, which, you know, really PSMA RLTs have largely replaced radium as the preferred treatment, even in patients with bone-only disease. So I guess the question becomes, in someone you're going to give radium maybe after PSMA RLT, would you add enzalutamide with the hope that there be some synergy? I think we're going to struggle with how to use that data.
Back to Sandy to finish this out. Any comments? Are you using radium now? And what do you think about this combination with enzalutamide?
I mean, I use radium for those patients who have, who are not candidates for SBRT, but you could have like four mets. Do you want to reserve lutetium for post-radium? There is some safety data that has been demonstrated. So I think you want to use all your drugs that have demonstrated improvement in longevity. And I certainly think PEACE-3 sort of revives the use of radium. How we use it, whether it's in combination, and what sequence, I think remains to be determined.
So again, I'm just so happy we have so much data to talk about, because for those of you who are kind of new to oncology, this is pretty new, but having a huge influx of data in oncology in general, but also specifically in prostate cancer. I want to thank Sandy and Matt. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to come back and talk about lung cancer.